Could you just try to refresh the browser? Maybe that will do it. I assure you it was fine half an hour ago when we connected for the first time. So something might have happened.
Any change now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, good.
Thank
Great.
you.
So, yeah, welcome everybody. And it's great to be with you all again. It's a regular occurrence to me of the last few years. And over the last few years, I've concentrated more on the issue. I live in the Galilee in Israel, and I've had many, many years' experience of working with Palestinians and Israelis on peacemaking and on working within the difficult system of a country that's perpetually at war. And of course, in the last 10 days or whatever, the week, rockets again over me from the Galilee, from now from Iran and from Lebanon, and going the other way as well. And alarms and sirens constantly, etc. The truth is that I've talked quite a lot about this in the past in Sangha Live, and actually, I don't feel like talking about it again after 2 years being under fire here in the Galilee in the, from the October the 7th. My book, How to Thrive in Hard Times, does go into some of these things, but right now, I want to kind of go into a deeper Dharma issue and and really explore the issue of the diversity of our experience and how that can really help us. And it does have an effect on the way we look at the other people we don't agree with, we don't like, we don't want, etc., which is so much growing in the world and creating so much conflict. As Jörg said, I'm the I started Tovana, the Israel Insight Society, and it just represents also some very, very beautiful things that are happening in this part of the world, despite huge difficulty and very hard political system. And a lot of violence, but there's beautiful flowers as well. And one of them is the a Buddhist Dharma community here, which is growing and big. And we have 42 retreats in the year, and so many activities all through the country. Anyway, this evening, what I'd like to concentrate in on is diversity, the richness of our experience when we open our spiritual eye, our inner eye, and how we work with that and how we can look at it and discover it. The key quote here is from Dogen, the 13th century Zen master, who said, "The Dharma way is to meet ourselves, or meet the self. Meeting the self is to lose the self. Lose the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, to be enlightened by all the th 10,000 things of the world, the richness of the world." That's often not clear to us. How can we be enlightened by the things of the world? It's easier for us to say, okay, I can understand how I can be enlightened by pure awareness, by deep knowing, by deep awareness, by deep meditation, by samadhi and so on, concentration. But to be enlightened by the 10,000 things of the world, how does that work? So that's the subject for this evening. I'd like to practice together. And then I'll give a talk, and then I'd be happy to open it to discussion as you wish. We'll have, I think, at least 20 minutes for discussion, maybe a bit more. We'll see. And so that's the program for this evening. And I'd like to start with a meditation, if that's okay with all of you. So, settling in and a little image with some humor. I have chickens here. I went to feed them this morning. One of the chickens is sitting on eggs. I noticed that when a chicken sits on eggs, it wiggles a bit and then it just drops to where it is and becomes immovable. So, can we feel that we're like a chicken sitting on eggs? We can move a little bit, get ourselves a kind of right place, a sense of rightness in the posture, and then settle immovably in our place, take our seat. And allow to start with a movement that is, I think, so needed, especially these days, which is refuge. Refuge, not necessarily in a very Buddhist concept or framing, but refuge as coming home. We drop into this present moment. And it's not technical or neutral. It's a sense of coming home. We arrive into presence. We arrive into awareness. We are here. And this is our true home. And we align ourselves with the Dharma, with what appears when we are open and aware. Dharma, that's our home too, a deeper way of looking at things. It's deeply allowing and receiving things that arise. We can start with the outside world, maybe sounds, we can sense our body present in space, in context. There is forward and behind, there is the sky above and the earth beneath. We can really connect with the earth beneath that is pulling us, that is inviting us. We experience it clearly. And then we can go into the inner world. Many of us will be used to the breathing as the kind of carriage that carries us deeper into awareness and presence. So let us be carried by the breathing, the soft, gentle, natural breathing. And a little bit let go of the sense that it's us doing it. The breath is coming and going. We are being breathed. And as we do this, can we open one of the doorways into the diversity of experience? Can we see how this breath is totally unique and rich? Every part of this breath is different. Every breath has never happened before. If we experience it, for example, in the rising and falling of the tummy, all the parts of the stomach have a different experience. And every breath is expressed differently. So each breath becomes a whole world of changing experiences. And if we wish, we can drop into body sensations. Exploring the sensations in the body. For example, the legs and the hands. The chest and the tummy. As we get closer to bodily life, we begin to hear all the voices, all the stories of our cells and tissues. For example, the hands, it's a quick look that knows hands. But if we get closer, the experience of the fingers opens up. Changing, flowing sensations that are constantly different. Meditation as deep listening, we begin to hear more and more voices from our bodily life right now. And of course, the mind. There may be thinking, and instead of relating to thought as disturbance or distraction, can we relate to thought like body sensations, voices in the mind that want to be heard? Pictures, words, memories come by themselves, go by themselves, all different, all passing. And our readiness to witness thought allows them to show us their richness, their diversity, their originality, creativity. We can see thought as flowers, as in a Mahayana text. There's ecology of mind. But it's helpful to leave them after some time and go back to the body. Checking through the body, pleasant or unpleasant sensations. Not choosing one or the other. Allowing expression. If it's unpleasant, say a pain or a stress or a tension, just seeing inside how many aspects the shape that borders, the sharpness, the changing sensations there. And we can also explore if there's anything at the level of feelings. Maybe there's something in the heart that wants to express, that wants us to hear, to be there for a feeling. Can be very subtle, a little bit of uncertainty, a little bit of insecurity, a little bit of love, a little bit of softness and care. But this too, when we look at the heart, we see a stream like water. sound of water constantly bubbling and changing. And we'll just take another minute with this sense of allowing, giving permission for the voices within to be heard. Okay, and we can take a deep breath and let it out and slowly, slowly open the eyes. Okay, so I'd be happy to give a talk and then we can have some dialogue. And I see there's a very nice flower in Shosh's square. It just reminds of the image of flowers in the mind. We're very used to some very basic Dharma teachings that Dharma practice, the Buddhist teaching is very clear and very beautiful in teaching us the freedom from the pressure to keep maintaining and constructing our habits, our psychological pressures, our patterns, what our traumas, what holds us, what imprisons us in a way. And helping us to get off the wheel of samsara. And a lot of letting go of needs, of preferences, of noise in the mind and in our life. of diversions and distractions and struggle. So this is something we all know. The Suttanipata, the Buddha said, in every direction there are things we know and recognize and meet. We can leave them. Don't let consciousness get stuck on the products of existence, on things that come and go. So that tends to invite a sense that we have to let go of things that come and go, that in a way it invites us to no thingness, namely emptiness or nothingness. And this is a kind of a deep teaching of the Dharma, that if we let go of needs, preferences, habits, constructions, we are invited to a more empty place, which is not the products of existence, but maybe the basis of existence. But in practice, we can get into a bit of a misunderstanding here, because it's very helpful not to see thought as a problem, as distraction, as disturbance, as noise. And we can get a bit over upset with noise, for example, noise in a retreat. And we can get a bit over the top with the sense of having to let go of things, let go of a pain, for example, let go of busyness with our constructions. What really does happen as we practice is that we are growing the witness mind, the mind that knows what is arising. And meditation is diving in and opening closed places, hidden places, stuck places. Meditation is about unpacking things, unpacking closed places. And we just did it very briefly, even with a pain, which seems to be a closed place. It's something, say, a pain in the body we don't want, so we label it as something we don't want. It becomes a little bit of a box. We have to deal with it, and we. But we really, meditation is about unlocking doors, including, for example, pain in the back. What is it? How is it? How is it changing? What is telling me? What am I doing with it? Where is it coming and going? Where is it turning into something else that's not painful at all? How all the time it's changing. And mindfulness works to unlock doors that are locked or that closed to us. I love the story, the Sufi story of a man, a Muslim in a prison. And he wanted to get out of the prison, so he wrote to his friend saying, please send a parcel with a hammer or a tools that, for me to unlock the door and get out. Well, he got a parcel, but it had no tools in it, just a prayer carpet. So he was very upset. He threw the prayer carpet in the corner of his cell, didn't know what to do, but he thought after a while, well, I might as well pray as it's here. So he prayed on the prayer carpet a few times a day. After a while, one day, he suddenly noticed when he was close to the prayer carpet that woven into the design of the prayer carpet was the plan of the lock of the door of his cell. And using that plan, he could open the lock and be free. So he had to get close to the tiny little woven sign in the prayer mat, not a hammer or a gun but just going into and seeing how it works, and there is freedom. So we unpack, as the Buddha said, all compounded things are impermanent. Everything is made of everything else. We unpack using awareness, the stories and their patterns, and the closed places of the mind and the heart and the body and the breath and the world. We unpack I have a book called How to Thrive in Hard Times, and I've been talking about it in previous meetings. But the introductory poem to this book is a short poem about this. Have you forgotten the edges of leaves, the soft fur of cats, the myths in the shapes of clouds, the stillness of the moon, the songs in the wind, your own soft breath, dissolving the boundary between you and the world? That's part of the poem. So, mindfulness is remembering the richness of life. But it goes further because the Buddha actually talked more about appamatta than he did about mindfulness sati. The last sentence, according to the text, before he died, was to tell the monks to practice appamatta seriously. Not sati, not mindfulness, but appamatta. And he, in the text, it's appamatta is in seen as a bigger tool than mindfulness by itself. And what appamatta means is seeing all the way, taking great care when you see. It's not seeing as neutral, it's taking care, it's being careful, it's paying a deep attention to what it is that you're looking at and going all the way. Sometimes people, I have a vegetable garden that I really enjoy and I work on it, daily. And sometimes people go in and say, wow, amazing vegetable garden you have. I'd love to go in and see. Oh, yeah, sure, go in and see. But do you realize you're stepping on tiny little new seedlings that I just planted? That's appamatta. It's not just being mindful, it's taking care. So, awareness is about less filtering in the mind, less of an inner sensor that says, this is good for me, this is bad for me, this is better, this is not. Mindfulness takes us to a place with less filtering, less preferences. Less preferences based on what I need, what I prefer, what I don't want. That actually closes doors to the world. If we have less preferences, we can open more doors to things that don't necessarily are good for us, not good for us. The world gets richer. We begin to see, a bee, we see a bee buzzing around, but we see that it's relationship to a flower. There is relationship going on all the time with everything. And if we are less busy with our needs, we will see everything as a relationship. Things open up and we see more all the time. I was struck in a retreat the other day where there was a woman. And she reported in a group. We have groups in the middle of retreat, and she was reporting in the group. She had tears in her eyes, but she sat 20 minutes watching an ant trying and struggling to get a small stick into its nest and failing. And she so identified with this one ant. That struggled and struggled to get the stick into the little stick into its nest and failed. And she had tears in her eyes. Okay, this is retreat. And it seems like crazy. What? This is craziness. No, it's not crazy. This is the richness of the world if we look at it with open eyes. If we see the elephant in the room, what troubles us, we see it directly, then things open up. For example, we also see the room. Not just once we see the elephant in the room, we also see the room. So mindfulness does something very fundamental, which is it empowers our consciousness, which is not captured or stolen so quickly by things that are needed or that we have issues with or that we are called or that we, it's not captured so quickly. Meditation works with mind. And when we work with mind, we begin to expand the power of mind. Citta is mind heart in the Pali. And it goes to bodhicitta, which is awakened mind heart. And this awakened mind heart is very open, very wide, very unselective, very limitless. And it develops all the time as we practice. As we keep meeting objects or experiences as the witness, then we get less tied in to the object. For example, we feel more present with the breath. There is a presence. Awareness is mixed with the breath. We have a sense of being aware of the breathing of the body or aware of a thought. This is development of citta, of mind heart. I'm reminded of Krishnamurti, famous, constantly saying, my first teacher way, way, way back, saying, "Con develop observation, not just the observer and the observed, the observer looking at a tree as the observed." It's not duality, observer and the observed. What you need to explore is the observation, what joins you and the tree. So we know this, but we maybe don't give it a lot of attention. Maybe it feels a bit subtle. But I think if we define in the simplest way bodhicitta, awakened awareness, as presence, we can begin to see how meditation fills our experience with a quality of knowing. We develop knowing. We feel more knowing. And then, because of that, we see, as in my poem, the myths and the shapes of clouds, the stillness of the moon. What helps us to see that is the sense of knowing. We notice more. We feel more freedom. And we allow more to come in. The Buddha, famous quote, said, "Citta, mind heart, is endless and radiant, shining, and experiences arrive as visitors." As we develop this knowing and get less caught up in what we need, what we want to see, what we don't want, our patterns and issues, we become more steady, we become more equanimous. Things seem more connected. We see the bee and the flower, we see the garden and our feet stepping on the small plants. We see things, we see ourselves in the world. Not just what we want. We see how we are with that cup of coffee, not just the cup of coffee. There is more of a oneness, and we have more of an ecological relationship to existence, to life. Things become more open and available, but equanimity, the steadiness, allows more to come in. Because we are steady and we are available and we are open and less preferences. And this allows the richness. And that's an important thing to understand in the practice, that if we are steady and equanimous, then we'll allow more to come in. I remember one time I was on a retreat in America with a Tibetan teacher. And there was a bulldozer working just outside the meditation hall, digging a ditch and making a huge noise. And the meditation hall was shaking. And there was 100 of us inside the meditation hall meditating. And the bulldozer was digging away, making a huge noise. And someone's asked the Tibetan teacher, "The Buddha once said you can be awakened from the sound of leaves. Can you also be awakened from the sound of a bulldozer?" And the Tibetan teacher was a bit flummoxed. He was a bit stunned by the question. And he thought about it for a minute and he said, "Yes, you know what? Yes, you can be awakened from the sound of a bulldozer. Indeed." I remember when I spent years in India, and one time in Varanasi one year, there was a meditation group of mostly Westerners sitting on the platform outside the big generators that were running the sewage disposal system of Varanasi. And that was his spot. And he invited everyone to come and sit there next to the big generators that were buzzing and humming inside the building and said, "Meditate on that sound and then gradually feel that that sound is filling the whole universe." So, if we have less preferences, more equanimity, more openness, less control, less what's the word I used? Filtering, then we begin to see more also. And this openness has more peace in it, with less preferences. And this is something I do want to say about underneath the conflicts going on in the world today are hugely based on us and them, and on distance. The them are not seen and not appreciated and not known. And we don't get in their shoes, they become threats and they're kept away. And yet, clearly, in my experience directly here in Israel and Palestine, getting close to Palestinians, and you see what gifts they can bring us, what gifts this community can bring. What gifts each community can bring to the other. I experience it actually in the Galilee, where we have very good, relatively good relationship between Jews and Arabs and in the Western Galilee. And every time there's a wedding or a family event, and we go there to the Arab villages, they come to us. And we see that there's so much that they can give us in the way they look at things and differences that they bring, in the language that they bring, in the history that they bring. Diversity is it brings benefit. And it's same with ecology, human ecology. The more, the healthier the ecology, the diversity, it brings benefit to all. I was very touched, actually. I cried when I heard this song. One of the there's a British musician called Nitin Shawhney that maybe some of you know, and he has an album called Immigrants, And there, in that album, there is a song. And one of the lines in this song is, "His skin is earth, my eyes are sky, our differences we glorify." It's a very beautiful line. So let's get back to the Zen quote that I gave at the beginning. How did we become enlightened by the 10,000 things of life? Well, we simply get enlightened by small things. Small things can wake us up with an expanded, open sense, less selective citta, mind heart, witnessing, develop mind heart. There's a story in the text which I love about a woman became a nun called Patachara, and she was in it's a one of the suttas, and she was in terrible, terrible. She lost her family, and she was in great mourning and grief. But the power of her suffering certainly helped her to awaken, and she was awakened one day when she simply poured water over her feet as she was washing her feet, and there's just a simple observation that all water flows downhill. All water flows down. That was enough, and at that moment she was awakened. And small things are the source of awakening for us because they point us to the big. You'll probably know William Blake's quote, famous quote, "To see a world in a grain of sand." In a grain of sand, you see a world, and certainly in a breath, by the way. "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. To hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." When we look at ourselves, the details, the layers, emotion, for example, even emotion like pain and sadness and anger. When we look at an emotion, it has layers, it has levels. Under sadness is compassion. Under anger, there can be love, because we want to protect something, we want to hold something. We see layers inside ordinary experience of touch, of sensation, of the senses. If we open the eyes, we see so, there's so much that we see, and it's beyond the duality of preferences. I have a poem also in the book, How to Thrive in Hard Times, that I want to read. It's called "Diamonds Sparkle in the Air." Diamonds sparkle in the air and are quenched underwater. Salt once was money in the desert, but is worthless by the sea. Value is noticed when it is missing. The pure shines out of darkness but is invisible among the angels. Insights illuminate space but are lost among themselves. We hold precious what is not ordinary, until we know that the ordinary is precious. And water that hides diamonds sparkles like them. When we look at ourselves, maybe we see thousands of lives in us. The Buddha, on his night of awakening, according to mythology. He saw thousands and thousands of past lives. But when we look in ourselves, maybe we see thousands and thousands of our past lives. Every day, every day, we are thousands of people and experiences. Are you the same as you were 2 minutes ago? Never mind when you're 5 years old, but even yesterday, are we the same? We ourselves have thousands of lives. We are a kaleidoscope. I have to say that sometimes this can be a bit overwhelming. It's true. I had an experience not so long ago, which was really strange. I went to the bank in the local town called Naharia. I haven't been to the bank for years, but someone asked me to go in there. And I had a bit of a brainstorm, I have to say. I had no idea how this thing worked called the bank. I just didn't understand the rules of the game at all. I went in the bank and I just didn't. What am I supposed to do now? And why does it, where does, what does people expect from me? And what are they all doing? What are their eyes saying? And how does this thing work called this bank? Maybe it was the meditation, my meditation in the morning just kind of created some sort of blank page. So I went out of the bank and went out into the town, and I bet I felt pretty well the same. And I saw everyone walking in the street, and I wasn't quite sure what they were all doing and what was holding this thing together and where everybody was going and what they had in their mind. So it was a kind of a, and I thought, my God, I've got Alzheimer. But then I checked myself and I didn't, certainly didn't have Alzheimer. I went through the checklist and I felt it was more of like a kind of sudden wave of a bit overwhelming sense of non-familiarity of just the simple life of today. But it can be a bit more overwhelming. And of course, it didn't last long. Then I was back to function. But it can be overwhelming to see too much too quickly. And our spiritual life, we have to be trusting that it's okay to see a lot, but slowly, slowly, we develop it slowly. If we sensitivity, if it's too quick, we can feel disturbed by too much going on and too much happening. And I don't have a skin yet of an elephant. I feel I'm. I don't have a skin, and we can get that to that sense in meditation. I have a feeling that some of you might want to ask that question, so maybe I'm preempting it right now as well. That if we, and there's lots and lots and lots of spiritual stories of great spiritual masters that went through periods when they felt they didn't have a skin and they were just oversensitive, as the awareness, as chitta, as consciousness expands it. Its boundaries and opens more doors, then it can all get a bit overwhelming. But that doesn't last. And there is a healthy, the Dharma is very healthy because it has other things in it as well. It's not just intense meditation. It also has Sangha, it also has other checks and balances in it. And we can develop slowly. Open the wisdom eye slowly, step by step, and there is a lot of support in that in the Sangha and in the Dharma itself. It's not a super high pressure instant awakening, and I don't think instant awakening is at all helpful. I think we have to be steady and develop every step of our awareness. We develop more equanimity and steadiness to stand our ground in the middle of the ocean. But when we do that, we will see many, many interesting and strange fish down there in the ocean. And that's the diversity, the 10,000 things that awaken us. So thank you. So yes, be happy to have any responses and feedback, question. And there's one in the chat. Maybe it'd be easier for me, George, if you could read the chat. Do you mind?
Yes, certainly. I can do that, Stephen. So there's a question from Lee. Hi, Stephen. A bit of to off topic, but I'd like your advice. My best friend died in 2017. It's been a struggle. But sometimes I feel he's near me, watching me for a few seconds in a good way, especially when I at my Buddhist altar at home. I know this ain't really a Buddhist thing in general. What do you think? Do I need to let go or embrace the feeling? Is my friend alive, floating through the universe, somehow communicating with me?
My response is that it's a very beautiful thing that you're saying. And I don't think you need any theory about it, my view. This is just my own personal view. I don't think you need a theory, but I think you can feel it. It's a voice inside and maybe a voice outside too. It doesn't really matter, in my view. But if it's a voice that brings you, and it brings you closeness and reminder, and your relationship and your love is there. It can be not so different from the voices of the Buddha received when he was in his thousands of previous incarnations. It's all right, and I don't think you need to let it go actively. My view would be to celebrate it. It anyway will come and go by itself. The voice will come and go in a natural way. So I think you need neither to hold on to it nor to actively let it go. Just see it as, in a way, a bit of a blessing that enriches your life, and leave the theory about it. Just, it's a visit. Like the Buddha said, experiences are visitors. Your friend is visiting you. And I think it's, in my view, it's lovely. Yeah, Jules, hi.
Hello, Stephen. Thank you so much. Wonderful talk. I'm here in Cambridge in the UK. And I just wanted to go back to what you're saying about the noise of the bulldozer. So I remember when I was in a meditation class many years ago, and there was a skate park outside the hall where we meditated. And I remember the teacher saying, because we all became aware, you got the sense of the whole group becoming aware of this noise of the skate park. And he said, and the skate park, the skaters, that's all nature too. And I remember feeling, it's all of it is nature. It's the nature of our world and the world. And it just led me to think about, sometimes I get caught on thinking I need to create the right conditions to practice, And that I is there something about, all the conditions are always right? Because, if we have no choice, if we're stuck in a really difficult situation, either physically a noisy situation or whatever, we can still practice. But I sometimes find I get caught in, well, when it's quietened down, or when this, when that. And so there's that tension between, yes, you the it is helpful to have good sort of pleasant conditions, if you like, or quietness or whatever. But I don't know what my question is, but
No,
it's
you've
just
said it. Yeah, I think your question is absolutely clear. I think that there is also a wisdom here that when we are developing our practice, and at certain times, maybe more at the beginning, but at certain times when we feel vulnerable or we feel shaken up or we feel it's fine to say, I want to choose conditions for practice. This is why we go on a retreat. And it's healthy to say, I am not ready yet to be able to take the whole universe as my conditions for practice. I need to develop conditions that are helpful. But in an ultimate sense, you're absolutely right. There is no conditions that are needed for practice because the whole world is there in front of you every moment. So that is your field. Bulldozer or no bulldozer. In the end, yes, there's no point in running after special conditions or silence or anything else in the end. But I think on the way, it can be helpful. And we have to, that wisdom of my practice is not now at this minute strong enough. So I do need to create certain conditions. That is a wisdom that's fair enough. And at other times, you say, no, I don't care what goes on. I'm ready for bulldozer or no bulldozer. It's all the senses. They're in the present moment. I'm with them as they are. I allow life to be exactly what it is. I'm not asking for any conditions at all, and my practice is good and is going to cope with that. So that's a wisdom as well. And I think that we should go beyond the rules and more like listen to where we are and the wisdom of a kind of self-reflection here. And then from there we choose what we do.
Thank you. Yes, it's a kind of skillful means as well. It's skillful means.
Exactly.
Oh,
It's skill.
there's no kind of, well, it's always this way or that way and right or wrong or whatever. It's just
Absolutely.
skillful means. Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else?
Okay, so there's another question from Deborah.
Okay.
She says, beautiful talk on the other, because you have found how to make peace in a contentious area, and because accurate language is important, I would love your help with a word that triggered my Yiddish group on October 7th, Palestinian, for some Arabs and not Jews, etc. How would you suggest moving deeper in dialogue?
Well, the basis of dialogue is deep listening. And I would say just be ready to hear the story of the other. Whatever that takes, whatever that needs. I remember one of the many, many peace dialogues that we did, a Palestinian young man said to me, it's an illusion. The Jews think that we want to go back to live in Tel Aviv, where we used to live our villages. No, I don't want to go back and take over 80 years ago what was my house, but I do want the Jews, Israelis, to listen to my story. That's all I'm asking. And I think there's a great gap in the listening. And so the first thing is find any way we can to listen to the story of the other and the other listen to your story as well. Secondly, to be very aware of what's not coming with instant solutions, but to be very aware of the kind of seeds that we plant. To ask people, what are the seeds that we're planting? And in peace work, this is perhaps not so much relevant because you ask about dialogue and ask about connection. But one of the things that is keeping the conflict going is a sense of there's nothing we can do. It's all useless and hopeless. They hate us, we hate them, etc., etc. It's all stuck. And actually, it's not at all stuck. But it depends on us sowing the right seeds and being aware, a little bit of, more aware of what's possible. So I'm not quite, I don't quite, maybe you can say a word more about the language. You said something about language, Deborah, which I didn't quite understand. What did you want me to be more exact about? It wasn't clear from what you said. I understand exactness is important, but maybe you were talking about Palestinians, Arabs, Jews, etc. These labels, which are very, very difficult, both the Palestinians and so Palestinians inside Israel, who are Israeli Arabs, they very often said, "Look, please talk to me as a Palestinian living in Israel." They want that label, prefer that label, but they also say, "It's give up because you will never get it right." As the Palestinians and the Jews say something similar. I mean, it's not a Jewish problem; it's an Israeli problem. It's not an Israeli problem; it's a Jewish problem. The label's kind of a mess. So that's maybe why my language is a bit is also reflecting that. So I actually prefer to use the word Palestinian rather than Arab in general, because it gives respect to a culture and a society and an identity that they feel. They feel more Palestinian than they feel Arab. So I would tend to respect that and use the word Palestinian, even if they are living inside Israel, because Palestine isn't a country. It's more like a people or an identity. Thank you. Okay, I think I might have solved the problem there. Yeah, great. Thank you for the question anyway, Deborah.
Okay, and then actually I overlooked this one from Seth, who was previously written. It's a totally different issue and an important one too, of course. So Seth questions, I'm working on letting go of adult children making decisions. I don't want them to feel mom is not as interested in us. Do you have any advice on helping me let go in a better way?
I think letting go, should we say 50% is letting go, but the other 50% is letting go is being really, really clear of what it is you're letting go of. And for example, letting go of something inside us, a psychological position or a psychological pattern. It's really important to name and be clear about the pattern before we let it go. Otherwise, it will always be there behind the scenes and disturbing us and coming up from other angles. So I think it needs a lot of dialogue with your adult children to see their view, to see how they are with things, to see how they would be if you let go. How would it would affect them in dialogue? You can see how it would affect them if you let go more about decision making or, about them. I can give you a painful story, a painful example right now here where I live. Including my own family, grandchildren, they are all conscripted to the Israeli army. My grandchildren, other people's grandchildren, other people's children. As peace makers, my first reaction would be try to get them to stop that, not to go to the army. That would be a kind of a almost like a strong position to take, but as a basis, I would say yes. I mean, that's view. Some of you may disagree, but my view would be, it is not helpful for these children to go into the army, for them and for the other sides. But if they really say, "I want it. This is my life. My society asks for it. This is my contribution I'm making," then I would say, if that's your decision, I will not stand in your way, but find a way where you, in that role, can be kind and compassionate wherever you are. If you are a soldier, be the kindest, compassionate soldier you can be, and try and stop as much suffering as you can. But it's a very hard one, and I would say, try and do everything you can to soften it, to help them to change, to give other options. But in the end, say, "I respect your autonomy as a human being, adult human being in this world. You have to take your stand, and I let go, and say I will try and stop you at until this point, but then in the end it is your decision totally, and I respect whatever decision you make." So I think it's kind of, you can't deny your choices in life. I think you have to express yourself in that way, but there's a language of not totally stepping back and saying, I mustn't make any voice of advice or suggestions. That's the one side, and the other side is too much interference and control. And the middle way would be to express it, to say it, to give ask them for your permission, for their permission, for you to give your view, and then let go. So, anything more? I did see a comment that said, if Israel would abandon its army, what would happen to Israel? And I think it's a very theoretical question. It won't happen, but there can be a journey. There can be a journey where towards that, yes, Israel should take the journey, and along with all the neighbors, and choose peace rather than a constant confrontation. There's lots and lots that can be done instead of the military option. Okay, so shall we wrap it up?
Yes, we're on top of the hour, so
Okay.
I'll let you close the
So,
session the best way you.
okay. So I'm very happy to see you all, to say goodbye, love you, and leave you. Let's just take a moment, because we've raised one or two difficult issues here. And we've also expressed some of the bigger picture of awareness. So let's just take a moment of appreciation of the Dharma and of ourselves, and a kind of gratitude that we do have a way of looking at things that is bigger, that is potentially helpful, that enriching our life. And just sort of drop into this place of appreciation for a moment. Appreciation includes ourselves. It includes ourselves for our commitment and our journey. Our Sangha, the Sanghas from the beginning of time, the huge resource of the Dharma, we give appreciation to it all. And the way to give appreciation to the Dharma is the commitment to live it, to live the Dharma. Okay.